you have questions about digital photography, you've come to the right place. Welcome to Photo Focus. Here's your host, Scott Bourne.
Thank you for joining us on another edition of Photo Focus, the original Q&A podcast brought to you by Adorama. Much more than a camera store, go to Adorama.com to find out what they got going on, because it's a lot. Today is a very special day on Photo Focus because he's back by popular demand all the way from Oregon. It's Kevin Kubota. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, Scott. And you know what? It's Oregon.
I'm just joking.
Oregon. I know you know, but I'm just making sure the listeners know, because we're very sensitive about people mispronouncing our state.
It's like the most mispronounced state, isn't it?
Yeah. It's almost like we have an accent over here or something.
Yeah,
like
right.
Oregon, yeah.
Glad to have you on the show. Kevin has a new book, folks, The Lighting Notebook. I'm telling you right now, it's one of the – we get tons of lighting questions here at Photo Focus because – It's a hard thing for people who don't have experience to know how to deal with light, and it's obviously the most important thing in photography. Kevin, you've managed somehow to come up with what I call a workshop in a book. Basically, it's the most valuable resource I've seen on lighting in a long time. I want to congratulate you for it.
Oh, thanks, Scott. I appreciate that. It was a really fun book to put together, and we've gotten tremendous feedback, and it's been up there in the top sellers on Amazon, so we're stoked on it, and it's been helping a lot of people. It's just kind of my main goal anyway, and so thanks for bringing it up.
Yeah, I also want to thank you for your contributions to our new book, Going Pro, which is not doing quite as well as your book, but it's still doing well.
That's a sweet book, too.
We appreciate your images and your advice that you put in that book. Okay, as is our custom here at Photo Focus, we're going to toss the first question to our special guest. It comes from Peter Williams in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. And Peter says, what's the difference between a gold, a silver, and a white reflector? I feel like we should have Jeopardy music playing. Da, da, da.
Well, let's see. Peter, the gold one's going to cost you a lot more, just for the price of gold these days.
I'll let you handle this one, Kevin.
Yes. You know. So, that's a good question. And reflectors, people sometimes think, well, a reflector is a reflector. What's the difference? And really, it's just the color and the intensity of the light that it reflects. So if you want that California sunshine girl look, then a lot of people use a gold reflector because it'll pop a warm, really crisp light back onto your subject. And if you want something that's crisp but doesn't have that warmth, then the silver works really well. And if you want something that's a little softer and very neutral, reflecting back just the colors that it sees, either from the sun or whatever object is around you, then the white works really well.
Yeah,
and I personally tend to go more with white reflectors. And there's one other one in here that you didn't mention that some people forget to think of as a reflector, which is actually a diffusion. Mm-hmm. These discs, I'm assuming he's talking about discs, which
right.
are very
right.
common, you know, the pop-up discs. And there's also a white diffusion disc, which you use to diffuse the sun or a light source. But I often use that as a reflector because it's nice and soft. It has a very natural reflected light feel, but that's kind of a personal thing, and that's really the basic difference between them.
Yeah, I agree with your answers 100%. The only thing I'll add is that there are times when you want specularity,
mm-hmm.
and if so, that's when I use the silver reflector.
Yeah, it gives you a nice crispy little
specular light. I mean, particularly, like, for instance, if I'm photographing somebody with dark skin,
mm-hmm.
I will often use a silver reflector because I want to pop extra something in there, a little zinger.
Yeah, there you go.
It's a great question, Peter. We appreciate you asking it. And here's how you can ask a question of the Photo Focus team. Just send us an email to photofocus@me.me. That's Mary Edward, me.com. We cannot guarantee we'll answer your question on air because we get thousands of questions. But if we like it, if it's short, if it's pithy, and if you tell us your name and town in particular, you will increase your chances. Although the staff has been a little reticent lately to exclude people because they didn't give their town. I'm going to have to get on them about that. But Peter gave us his town. He was from Canada, making us internationally beloved right off the bat, Kevin.
Whoop, whoop. Yay, right. Canada.
The second question comes from Herman Goldman in New York City. Says, I know you shoot a lot of video. I think he's talking to me, Kevin, but maybe you do too. Is it better to use a DSLR or a dedicated video camera? Are you doing any video work, Kev?
We are doing some video work. Yeah, we're doing a lot of video for recording tutorials and things we do, and also for some of our events we shoot video as well. Personally, I use a DSLR because I like the lenses that I can use and the ease of use. But what do you use, Scott?
Well, I use both. I mean, the DSLRs are a lot of fun. You can do some very creative things. But I've moved to using some dedicated video cameras for the bigger projects just because you don't have to mess with, you know, kind of gearing them up. They're just ready to go. You don't have to add stuff to make them do the things that you need them to do. You have to attach a device that lets a microphone attach to your DSLR, for instance, whereas that's already – there's usually an XLR connector on a dedicated video camera. I like the Canon XF series. That's what I've been using a lot. But I do have a C300 on order.
C300. That's a fancy name for something new that I don't know about yet.
Oh, that's the new kind of like – not really a competitor to the Red camera. It's in that ballpark.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's $15,000 to $20,000, and it's a monster. But I think you can make wonderful video with the DSLRs, but it's a lot more work, and it's particularly hard with focus. That's the thing most people have trouble with, Kevin.
Uh-huh. Yeah, getting the focus just right and maintaining the focus is tricky.
You gotta have a focus puller.
Mm-hmm. The viewfinders are tricky to use. You know, a lot of people put the a special viewfinder over the back of the
I use the Zacuto viewfinder,
Zacuto, yeah. That's what we use, too. And that helps a lot. It makes it a lot more manageable to get your focus just right.
I wouldn't even think about shooting a lick of video without it. Mm-hmm. It's the number one accessory I recommend, the Zacuto Z-Finder or a variant thereof. I really think that helps. But the big issue is focus. Now, everybody likes these cameras because they can use a really shallow depth of field, but that means it's hard to focus.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's kind of ironic too, is that when they first started using them for video, everybody was so excited because they were lighter and easier to use, but then you have to attach all this stuff to them to make them actually work, you know, with your microphone inputs and your racks and your rigs and your all these accessories, that it ends up being as bigger than a normal video camera anyway once you get all the stuff on it.
Trust me, I know that all too well. Let me tell you, they say it takes a village. Well, it does take a village to shoot video.
Yeah.
I mean, it is the most eye-opening experience to me a few years ago when I did my first serious, like as in for money, video project down in Florida. I mean, it you got to have a crew.
Yeah.
You really do. It's just not – I mean, as still photographers, we're used to kind of maybe one assistant, but generally it's more of a solo practitioner kind of thing. But, boy, not with video. You got to have grips. You got to have people to pull the focus. You got to have all kinds of stuff. So, anyway, I think it depends on what you're doing, Herman. That's the main answer, which, you know, that's the answer we give to almost every question here at Photo Focus, but that's the primary answer. All right, let's move on to Dean Blowers, who – hails from Stoke, England. I have no idea where that is, but thank you for the question, Dean. He says, when people say to put your camera and lens in a Ziploc bag, so the condensation forms on the bag, not the lens, do I need to put just the body and lens that is not in my camera bag in the Ziploc bag, or all of the lenses that I will be using on that shoot? I think I'll take this one, Kevin, because I've talked about this before. Mm-hmm. I don't see you going out and doing like lots of weddings or anything at Yellowstone in the winter.
Not too often. And, the Ziploc bags, unless they have a special logo on them, I just won't touch them.
They've
got to be branded, you know.
Yeah, if you're carrying stuff into extreme environments, whether it's in your camera bag or not, you may want to put everything inside Ziploc bags, Dean. I try to not – if I'm going into extreme weather environments, I try not to take my camera bag. I use a vest. And then I only bring those things out into the field that I know that I know that I know that I know that I'm going to use. And everything's in a Ziploc bag. That's the best way to do it. And what this does is this keeps the condensation on the bag, not the gear. Because if you get condensation on your gear, first of all, it's really hard to shoot when it's all fogged up.
Yeah.
Second of all, it's not good for it. And it's the leading cause of mold inside lenses. And just a tip for you, if you're going to buy a used lens that's got mold in it, run, don't walk away, because it's bad. Can't be fixed. So My advice is put everything in the Ziploc bag. Rather be safe than sorry when you're going to go into cold weather extremes. And, of course, it's December, so, you know, it's the time of year where, at least our part of the globe, Kevin, it's pretty cold.
Yeah. So, Scott, when you're doing that with the bags, I'm assuming when you're ready to use it, you pull it out, and it's okay to just pull it right out into the cold air?
Yeah.
The bag?
Yeah. The bigger problem is actually going the other way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you go back
from the cold back into the warm.
Yeah, you
right?
go back into the hotel room.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just leave it sit for about an hour. And yeah. I actually have some special bags that I won't promote here because they cost a ridiculous amount of money and I think they're overpriced. But that I use. And I have to do this a lot because I work a lot in the cold.
Mm.
It's not fun.
Okay. Yeah. Another things to think about that you just don't often take into consideration. Yeah.
Well, it's one of those things where, you know, you go through all this trouble. You trek on snowshoes. You freeze your, you know, what's off. You got to take 20 batteries because they only last 5 minutes each. And you make a great shot. Somebody sees it and goes, yeah, that's nice.
Do you know what I went through to get that shot?
They don't care.
Yeah.
They don't care at all. All right. Before we take the next question, I want to thank my good friends at SmugMug. SmugMug has been a sponsor here a long time. They take good care of us. But before they were a sponsor, we started hosting video with them. In fact, all the Photo Focus videos have been hosted there for a long time. It's the best video hosting solution I know of. But beyond that, it's a great place to sell your photographs. If you're a photographer and you want to post your pictures online and sell them, SmugMug Pro is the way to go. Check them out. You can click on the banner on the Photo Focus homepage. It will take you right over there to SmugMug. And if you want, just go to smugmug.com. But we appreciate their support of the Photo Focus show. Next question comes from somebody named Sarkar, S-A-R-K-A-R. First name, I won't even try to pronounce. Phonetics, please, people. How does one use the distance scale on a lens for photography and video? I have the EFS 1585 Canon lens. It really doesn't matter. The answer is pretty much the same for all. Do you want to chime in here, Kevin?
Yeah, sure. The distance scale is, you'll see the little lines, sometimes they're colored and they correspond, like on the older lenses, they used to be colored and they would correspond to an f-stop. So for a certain f-stop, you'll have a range of between the lines that will be in focus. So sometimes you could even focus without even looking through the lens if you knew the exact distance of your subject. But basically it tells you for this given f-stop, you have a range of from here to here in feet or meters that will be in focus. And it obviously changes depending on if it's a small f-stop or a larger f-stop. So as far as using the distance scale, I would say most people don't really use them anymore because we rely on our autofocus and through the lens focusing. But they do have their purposes now and then, but you know, I haven't used mine since I was learning about it back in school. I don't know about you, Scott, but do you use the distance scale still?
Well, the distance scale for me has primarily been for establishing hyperfocal distance.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, with most of the modern lenses, you can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
One of the things I like about people know that my favorite camera these days is the little Olympus EP3. Because the lenses have a legitimate focusing scale, and you can actually set hyperfocal distance on them. Same with the Leica and a couple other cameras. But in the video world, we use it for focus because, you know, critical focus. And what you hear about the movies, they say the actor didn't hit his mark.
Yep.
That mark is something that somebody literally took a tape measure and took it to the sensor plane or the film plane, if it's a film camera, and marked it like this is exactly 17 feet 2 inches. And that's where the actor's supposed to stand because that's where the camera's pre-focused.
Mm-hmm.
So the distance scale. But most of the distance scales on the new lenses are frankly worthless.
Yeah, they're not very accurate.
So, Sarkar, I'm sorry to say that it's not going to do you much good. You know, it's an approximation these days. It'll tell you about how far the subject is. But because the autofocus that's attached to any camera that will work with that 15-85 Canon lens is going to be so much better, you don't need to worry about it.
Mm-hmm. You know, one way it could come in handy if you're, for example, if you're shooting portraits and you're shooting a group of people, say you're doing a family portrait and you've got a group of people and you've got, you know, three rows deep of people, if you know that you are approximately, you know, there's about 4 feet between the first person and the back person, and you know, or you measure, or you could estimate it's about 4 feet, then you know you have to pick an f-stop that'll give you at least 4 feet in that focus range, and then you focus on the person right in the middle, and then the person in the front all the way to the back should be in focus at that f-stop. And, you know, that's kind of one way you could use it.
Well, that's sort of a variation of hyperfocal distance. The problem is it's kind of hard on these new lenses to see where that is, Kevin.
Yeah, I mean, you can't really tell exactly how many feet you have, but it'll give you, as long as you err on the side of giving yourself a little more room to work with, it can be helpful.
And if you have a camera with a depth of field preview button, that will help you to visualize that.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you have that button and you don't know how to use it, let me give you a tip. We're going to piggyback on this one, Kevin. You want to squint your eyes a little bit when you're looking through the viewfinder. It makes it a lot easier to see the depth of field preview button.
So okay.
Give that a try. And the other thing is some of the Canon cameras have an ability when you're in aperture priority mode to set a near to far focus point and adjust the depth of field to match.
Okay.
So there's all kinds of cool ways to do that, but generally the distance scale on the lens is the least effective these days. And I rue the day. By the way, I don't know what that means to say I rue it, but I've heard the expression I rue the day.
It sounds very majestic. It sounds like you know what you're talking about. So that's good.
Okay, we'll keep moving. Jim Hoffman writes to photofocus@me.com and says, I'd love to know what you look out for when buying used gear and that sort of thing. I see great prices on eBay occasionally, but I'm a little leery of that considering how little recourse you have. Have you ever bought a used lens, Kevin?
Yeah, Scott, I used to buy some used lenses, and I've bought some things on eBay before, and I fortunately haven't had any problems, but I do know some people that have, and I guess one of the biggest things, like mentioned in the question here, is you don't have a whole lot of recourse. Theoretically, you do, but in reality, it's a pain in the butt to have to send something back to someone or get them to make good on something that's not quite what you thought it was. I think if you're going to buy used, probably buying from one of the dealers that gives some sort of a warranty on it, lets you check it out and make sure it's all good before you're 100% committed to it, might be a way to go.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think you're always going to be safe if you buy from a reputable, nationally known camera store like Adorama or one of the companies that specializes in used, another one called KEH has got a good reputation. I think if it's a person known to you, that's also safe. I think eBay can be safe if the person has a really good long-term reseller rating. For instance, they've been on there for 5 years and they have a 99% positive feedback, something like that. I think you're safest when you buy from the big national camera stores. And you're also safest when you buy refurb, which you can also do sometimes from the manufacturer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Closer to new, but... Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's a problem buying used. The things to look for are if somebody says that they've rarely used the lenses and it's got tons of wear and tear, that's a problem. if there's dust or mold inside the lens, I wouldn't buy it at any price. Look for worn out connectors. For instance, the place where the lens screws onto the camera, on a camera or a lens where there's been a lot of use, that'll be worn. The bushings will be worn, and that can be problematic. Look for zooms that are loose. If they rattle or shake or they're loose, that's never good. Zooms are always more problematic, by the way, than fixed focal length lenses. When you're buying a used zoom, you need to be more cautious than when you're buying a used fixed focal length lens. Mm-hmm. Check all the buttons, dials, etc., and take test pictures if you can. Now, you can't always do that when you're buying through the mail, obviously, but if you're local, put a piece of newspaper on the wall, take a picture of it, make sure the stuff's sharp edge to edge and it works.
Yeah. On some of the cameras, too, they actually keep track of the shutter activations in the camera settings, and you can have somebody tell you what that number is, you know, how much it's been used.
Somebody smarter than me. Because I can never figure out how to do that.
Yeah. It's in some of the cameras and buried in the settings you've got about this camera, but... I don't think that can be fudged, but maybe it can be.
Well, if they can fudge the odometer on a car, they can fudge the, the shutter activation switch on a computer. Right, okay, exactly. Let's move on to the next question from Marty Grassy. Marty says, I love to take photos of great egrets and snowy egrets we have in New England during the warm weather. They are so white, I have real problem getting any detail in the feathers. By the time I reduce the exposure enough to get detail in the feathers, the rest of the photo is way too dark. What do you suggest? I know this problem well because I photograph lots of snowy and great egrets, but I want to do something fun here. I want to equate this to something that my guest host, Kevin Kubota, knows very well. The white dress that a bride wears is often the whitest thing in a scene at a wedding, and often many stops brighter than the surroundings. So, Kevin, what did you do as a wedding photographer to hold details in the whites?
Well, it's really the same no matter if you're shooting egrets or wedding dresses or anything where you have an extreme contrast. And there's important detail in the white, and that's the thing. Sometimes the whites, if they're, you know, specular highlights or things that really aren't important to hold the detail, then you don't have to worry about it so much. But in this situation and in a wedding dress, you have to have the detail there. And there's a couple ways to do it. And one is to take an incident type of reading, which is old school for using a meter and taking a reading. So that's a meter reading that tells you how much light's falling on the scene, and it doesn't take any of the reflectivity into account, which means that everything should render pretty much the way it should be. But that's really not practical when you're photographing egrets that are hundreds of feet away, or even a bride sometimes. So you could either spot meter. You can use a spot meter and place it on like the subject's face. Their skin tone is closer to medium. Or you could actually put it on the white dress and then adjust your exposure so that you don't want it normal, but you want to actually compensate for that to open up the exposure a stop or stop and a half. But if you got a good overall exposure, generally we try to expose so that we have the detail in the whites, and then the shadows are a little easier to open up, at least if you're shooting raw. I can get great detail from shadows that seem like they were a little too dark, but if the highlights are really blown, it's hard to get it all back and to get it look just right. So it is very important to expose those highlights just right.
Like we always say on this show, photography is about compromise. You got to decide which is more important, the details or the shadows. And we're going to get to that in another question here later. But I agree with you, Kevin. The key is shooting raw. Mm-hmm. If you're in that situation, shoot raw. That gives you the most data to work with in post. Hold the detail in the light. Let the shadows block up and fix it in post.
Yeah, yeah. It'll look a lot better with I've always found if my shadows are a little underexposed and I open them up, it visually is a lot better looking than if you were overexposing your highlights and then you try to recover them.
Oh, yeah.
Because the color shifts and you're just never going to get it back just right, and it won't look good. So make sure the highlights are where they need to be when you're capturing it.
Yeah, 255, it falls off the cliff.
Yeah, it's gone.
It's just gone. It's like we said last show, I was talking about this. It's like when you shot slide film, it'd just be clear at that point.
Mm-hmm.
There'd be nothing there. Hey, I wanted to take just a second to mention a very special deal I have just for Photo Focus listeners. It's from Animoto, animoto.com. This is a very cool place to get online slideshows with your pictures. And we have a special they're running. They've never done this before. Their Plus product, Animoto Plus, is only $30 a year. Gives you a lot more options than you get with the free product. But if you click on the Animoto Boto on the Animoto bug on the Photo Focus page, then what can happen is you're going to get 3 months free. That's right.
Mm.
3 months free. You're going to get 15 months for the price of 12. Click on that banner. It's on the Photo Focus homepage. It's going to take you to a special page, and I believe the code is PHOTODEC. And what will happen is you'll pay for 12 months and you'll get 15 of the new Plus service. Animoto is a great way to make online slideshows. You can throw video in there, stills. They got music for you. You can use your own music. It's extremely cool. It's extremely fun. And we like it.
It is fun. Yeah. I use Animoto a lot too. I love it. It's great.
It's the best way to go. So check them out, and we appreciate their support of the Photo Focus podcast. JC from Rockland, Ontario, Canada. We have a lot of Canadians today. On a fisheye lens, is the depth of field parallel to the camera or parallel to the curvature of the front of the lens element, i.e. is the focus area curved? Kevin, do you know the answer to this question?
I'm going to take a wild guess on this one, Scott. I'm not a technical guy. Well, sometimes I am, but my thought on this is that the plane of focus is still going to be parallel to the film plane or your LCD, even though the curvature of the lens is curved and it seems like you're going to have this curved plane of focus, but you really don't. I mean, at least what I've noticed with my lenses, even the ones that are widely curved in the front, that the focus plane, because of the way the lens is designed, it's designed that way to give you a flat plane of focus or a straight across plane of focus. It's not going to be curved. Otherwise, you'd have very odd looking images. And sometimes on these fisheyes and super wides, the edges will naturally be a little softer than the center if they're not a really super high quality lens. But I don't think that's exactly what he's talking about in this situation here.
No, we're not talking about a rectilinear corrected lens. We're talking about just a standard plane of focus. And I agree with you, Kevin, but my answer would also be, who cares? And here's why. If you shoot a fisheye lens at wide open, everything's still in focus. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you've ever used one of these lenses, you know, like F4 is tons of depth of field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's because of the very nature of these lenses. I mean, I shoot them wide open all the time and everything's in focus.
Right. Yeah. There's so much, like the hyperfocal that we were talking about earlier on a fisheye. Yeah. It's
generally
extreme.
Yeah. It's like from 2 inches in front of you to infinity at F4. So I think this question is one of those I would literally say who cares to. But we answered it because it was fun.
Yeah. It was a good question. He's thinking. He's thinking.
Yes, and some scientists will send me a 42,000-word email, Kevin, telling me we got it wrong.
Well, technically speaking, Scott.
Yes, yes. On the third Thursday of the month, if you're wearing red, fish do not live in water.
And their eyes are not this big.
Yes, just FYI, folks. No matter what we say, someone will take the opposite position just because it's fun. Kevin Griscott. Griscott. I have no idea. What do you think? Kevin Griscott? Is that it?
Griscott.
Okay. Thank you, Kevin Griscott, for writing in with your question. I had an occasion to shoot something that needed to be exactly level. I was using a Canon 7D on a Manfrotto tripod that had a bubble level. When I went to the camera's level function, I found that it didn't agree with the bubble level. So which would you trust? I went with the bubble. Ah, well, I think this is a trick question, Kevin. Mm-hmm. And here's why. The tripod may indeed be level at the point that the tripod's sitting, but the camera's going to be higher than the tripod. Mm-hmm. So just because the tripod is level doesn't mean the camera will be level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Those of us who are old enough remember what that laugh is from. Everybody else is going, what are they doing? So here's the thing. Is the tripod – so there's like all kinds of bubble levels we could be talking about here. Are we talking about one on the tripod itself, on the ball head that sits on the tripod, or on the camera? Because I have been in situations where those are all different. Mm-hmm. You know, you can have the tripod show level – but the ball head not. But ultimately, I will just say this. I trust the camera's levels the least because they're electronic. Mm. That was a really long answer. Do you have an opinion,
Kevin? I agree with you. I was going to say go with whatever bubble is closest to the film plane because I was thinking the same thing. If it's on the tripod and then you've got a head and maybe your quick release is not on tight and it's kind of tilting a little bit in the, you know, depending on what kind of equipment you got, you could have a little bit of flex between the tripod and by the time it hits the camera, just enough to throw off the level again. So it would be hard to say. So I would go if you had a level that was on the actual top of the pan head or the ball head, that would probably be the most accurate. But I've also found some of the levels, the bubbles, where it's just a little bubble in a tiny circle, they're not really that precise. It's hard to tell exactly, and you could be off by half a degree, and by the time that line carries up to the camera, if it's on a long ball head or something, that half a degree or 1 degree could turn into even more at the camera. So number one, making sure you have a good bubble level, and if it's closer to the base of the camera, then it would be more accurate.
There you go. We're in agreement.
Okay.
Next question is kind of long. I might skip through parts of it, but Larry Galper from Fargo, North Dakota said, I'd like to grab some shots of people begging on the street. Occasionally, I do drop some money in their buckets, and I'd like to take their photo for my blog and insert into print articles I write for publication. I'm hesitant to ask them because I feel anything verbal would be useless in terms of a release. Or would it? I realize you're not a lawyer, thank God. The other day, you talked about shooting people on a public street. And if one didn't use it in an advertisement, would it be okay? Well, that's a paraphrasing of what I said. But certainly in a commercial publication not sold to an agency as an ad. Is this okay without any written or verbal permission because it's a public street? I just got to start this the way I start all these questions, Larry. I am not a lawyer. I can't give you legal advice. If you need legal advice, you should hire a lawyer. I'll tell you what I would do. I would take the picture. If it's supposed to be photojournalistic, I wouldn't ask. I would throw a buck in there because that's just fair. And I would never try to use the picture in an advertisement or for anything other than art or editorial use without a release, period. Mm-hmm. You can't, and no agency will ever buy this picture, Larry, without a release. So you don't need to worry about selling it to an agency because they ain't going to buy it unless you got a release. It ain't going to happen.
Yeah. And the verbal, the part about the verbal release being useless, it is useless. It doesn't matter how much they promise you it's okay. It really is useless.
If it isn't in writing, it isn't real. So the general thing that I tell everybody is whether you need it or not, it's always best to get a model release.
Yeah.
But depending on where you live, and we have people from probably 24 countries listening to this show right now, the laws are going to be different. And then within the country you live in, the various jurisdictions, the prefectures in Japan or the states in the United States are all going to have their own different local laws. For instance, laws in Paris about this are much stricter than they are in the United States, likewise in the United Kingdom. So I think if you're thinking about this, you need to contact someone who practices law in your jurisdiction and ask them. But I'll tell you what I would do, and I told you. All right, let's take the next question. Yep. This is another one. This is from Ken Janseff. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Ken is a regular listener to the show, I believe. I inadvertently left my 32 gigabyte SanDisk CF card in my pants, and they went through the wash. we call that pre-Alzheimer's, Ken, and I definitely have that same problem.
Oh, that's sad, because I've done that years ago.
Well, so that's the point. We're all going that
really
direction.
Really early onset. Oh,
yeah,
no.
Early onset. He says, I have heard three different views on this. The card should be fine. People say they reuse them with no problem. The card should be fine, but if you're doing paid work, you might think twice about using it. The card is toast and should be thrown out. After a week sitting on my kitchen table to dry, I put in my 5D Mark II today. Card formatted fine. Took 15 or so test shots. All was okay. Being it was a fairly expensive card, should I trust it? Take a few minutes to cry about it and throw it away. What do you think, Kevin Kubota? What do you think about this?
Well, you know, I have to say from my experience, because I have done this exact thing and pulled cards out of the wash and let them dry out, and I reused them, and mainly because at the time I didn't have enough money to go buy more cards, so I said, heck, if it's going to work, I'm going to keep using it, and I never had any other problems with it. So that's my experience. Now, whether that's what we really want to legally recommend to you if you're shooting paid work, I don't know about that. I mean, I think it's always better to recommend being safe if you can afford to save that for things that are not paid jobs or not quite as critical. But they are pretty sturdy. And I used to, in my workshops, when I was trying to make a point, you'd take flashcards and I'd throw them on the ground and stomp on them and put them back in and use them just to prove to people that these are pretty sturdy devices. Again, that's not something I recommend doing, but the way they're designed, there are no moving parts, and generally, once they're dried out, if you didn't get any crud in there on the contacts, they should still work unless there was extreme heat that they were exposed to, like in the dryer, which could have fried some electronics, so that would make a difference. But if it's working fine, my guess is that it will work, but it may have a shorter lifespan.
Yeah, that's reasonable. I've done this too. I've used the cards for years, no problem. The good news is that on certain high-end cameras, the DSLRs, the pro DSLRs, they now are coming with multiple card slots. And you can usually configure those so that they write simultaneously.
Yeah.
So if it's a once-in-a-lifetime deal or you're getting paid for it, I like to figure them so they write simultaneously in case the very odd thing of a card failure were to happen, I'd have another one working. But I haven't had trouble with cards since the IBM MicroDrive days.
Oh, don't say that word. Makes me get the cold shivers thinking about
that. That sound you hear is thousands of people Googling IBM MicroDrive trying to figure out what the heck I'm talking about. But those were problematic. But once we moved to solid state, no issues. I mean, I will say this. SD cards, not so much. SD cards are a lot flimsier. I don't trust them as much. I don't like them, and I know a lot of people do, and the world's going that way, and too bad for me. But I think you're going to be fine, Ken, particularly if you've done everything that you told us you've done. But if it comes to, like, you deciding to do a paid job and relying on my advice, I didn't give you that advice.
Yeah. There's also another good tip, too, about just make sure everybody knows to label your cards. You know, give them a number or a date or some sort of ID, so that way if you have multiples, you can always make note, this was the one that went through the dryer, and then if you start to have problems, you can trace it back to that card.
Yeah, I used to put a W on mine that had been wet.
Wet, yeah. I had a code for stomped on by a cow and one that was flushed down the toilet. That was an F for flushed down the toilet.
Ooh. No. That's pretty bad, pretty sad. Before we go on, I do want to take just a second to thank Tenba Messenger Bags. I've used them a long time. They have saved my bacon more than once. They kind of look like a briefcase, which is something I think is cool about them, because you can't really tell they're a camera bag, so people aren't as interested in snagging them. That said, they don't hold a ton of gear, but they'll hold a laptop and a camera, or a couple of camera lenses and a camera body, whatever. I really like them. They're sturdy as all get out. And there is an ad for Tenba Messenger Bags on the photofocus.com homepage with a cool video, so check that out if you're interested, and thanks to them for their support of the show. Let's take the next question. From William Johnson in Los Angeles, California, says, I'd like to break into wedding photography as a business. Do you have any tips on how to go about, one, getting experience, two, getting gigs? Well, let's talk to one of the world's foremost wedding photographers and highly recognized, awarded, and plaudited, etc., Kevin Kubota.
Hey, well, it's not that hard to get started. It's a little harder to kind of keep your business, getting experience, the way I started it was offering my services to other photographers and to friends as a sideline shooter at a wedding. And one of the important things, I think, to making sure that long term that you have these photographer friends in the future is being real clear about what you're doing and what you're going to do with the photos. And I would suggest, say, contact local photographer, say, can I tag along on a wedding? Can I shoot, be an assistant? But make sure that you're real clear that you're either just going to give them all the photos you take, that you're just shooting it for the experience, and you're not going to be taking these photos and using them on your blog like you shot this wedding, because that'll really upset a photographer. And a lot of times, if you're willing to do that and just hand over the images and you say, hey, I learned a lot today, thank you, and you move on to the next, a lot of photographers will let you tag along as a second shooter or an assistant if they're needing somebody. And that's a great way to get experience. And then you need to get gigs. So then when you're ready to actually start booking jobs, you actually have to show photos that you took on weddings that you took, did by yourself. And the easiest way to do that is just to offer your services to friends or family, anybody who can't really afford a photographer or wasn't thinking about getting one, and say, hey, I'll do it. I'm not going to promise you anything. I'm not going to charge you anything, but I want to get experience and use the photos. And that's anybody can get a wedding job that way. It's not a job because you're not getting paid, probably, but it's a pretty quick and easy way to get experience and to get started and then build a portfolio. That's about all I have about that.
Oh, okay. I thought we lost you there for a second, Kevin. Sorry.
There.
I agree with everything that you said. Getting gigs is really about networking more than anything else. One way to do that is to connect with all the other wedding vendors, cake makers, dressmakers, DJs, limousine companies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Let them know what you're doing. The main thing I want to highlight about what Kevin said is be absolutely brutally upfront and honest about this second shooter arrangement. Make sure everybody's on the same page. Preferably get it in writing. Some people will let you second shoot, but only if you give up your copyrights, for instance. And you may need to do that your first couple of times out. I mean, whatever it takes to get the experience. But the last thing I want to suggest to you is that you try your first wedding ever, I mean ever, on somebody who's relying on you. Because no matter what disclaimers you give them, they're going to be disappointed and hate you for life if you don't get it done right. Because that's their special day. So do a couple of second shoots first before you try doing this on your own.
Yeah. Yeah, very important. And you owe it to the client or the pretend client, because this is a very special day for them. And you don't want to get their hopes up because it's a once-in-a-lifetime thing. So I think that deserves some respect from photographers.
Or in the case of one of my brides, a five-in-a-lifetime thing. So what, you know, yeah. Who's counting?
Once in a lifetime for now, anyway.
We gave her a discount otherwise. For the third, fourth, and fifth wedding. By the way,
we should have packages these days. You know, buy five wedding packages at once and get a discount on them all.
Yeah, probably not a good idea to advertise that to the bride when you first start, though. By the way, if you get married a second time with us, it's 10% off. Okay. Yeah. Let's take a question here from Mary Ellis in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and it's sort of apropos of what we discussed earlier. If you have to choose between holding detail in the highlights or the shadows, how do you decide, Kevin Kubota?
Well, we did definitely talk about that earlier, and I would hold the highlight detail would be the most important to me, presuming, of course, that really is the most important part of your subject. We also talked about, too, that maybe you're photographing a black bear in the woods and there happens to be a white bird sitting up on her shoulder, but really the black bear is the most important thing, then yeah, you want to make sure that bear is absolutely perfectly exposed, and then the bird may or may not work into the scene. But again, if it's that rare egret or whatever it is sitting on the black bear and that's the focus, then you want to make sure that the bird is exposed properly. So that's the first thing, is deciding what's the most important part of this photo. And then I would try to, if I had to choose, go for the highlights.
Very simply put, what's the most important thing in the photograph? If it's bright, hold the highlights. If it's dark, hold the shadows. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Yeah.
Again, it's always, always, always compromise. Although, like 100 years from now, it won't. You'll just sort of like look through your Ray-Bans and you'll have 72 hours of 5K video to choose from for everything you just saw.
Yeah. And 18 f-stops or more, right, of information there.
Right, and everything will be focused. Uh-huh. Mark Thomas from Vancouver, British Columbia, wrote to photofocus@me.com. Said, can you briefly describe your image backup archive workflow? I want to make sure I don't lose any valuable images to a blown hard drive. I will briefly describe mine and then ask Kevin to do the same. First of all, I don't think an image is real until it's in at least two places and preferably three. So what I do is I do shoot dual format cameras a lot of the time. So I have two cards taking the same picture. So I have a backup already. I get back to my office. I immediately offload them into Aperture, which is stored on a big RAID array for me. I won't bother with the brand name because this changes from time to time, and I'm probably moving things to Thunderbolt because it's even faster. After I do that, I immediately, on a separate RAID device, well, I will tell you, it's Weebie Tech. That's what I use right now. I make a copy of what Aperture calls a vault, and if you use Lightroom, just your catalog, it's the backup photos. I immediately pull the disk drive out of the enclosure. I put it in a plastic static-free box, and I take it home. That way I have a copy at home and a copy at my office, because it really doesn't do any good to have all your backups at one location if that place burns down. And then the last thing we do in our workflow at night, I have an automated system because I bought this big, huge server farm in the 90s that uses tape drives, believe it or not. We auto back up to our own version of the cloud every night. So I have a cloud version, a drive version at home, a drive version in the office. And then, and only then, I erase the compact flash cards. That's it for me. How about you, Kevin?
Yeah, mine's similar, minus the server farm from the 70s. Cause,
it was the 90s, actually.
Yeah. But we do similar. I whenever I can, I shoot two cards in the camera. One's backing up the other, so you have all the images on two cards. Throw them onto a RAID drive as my main working drive, and the RAID drive backs up to a second RAID drive. And I make sure that I have those. Now, we used to, for our weddings, we'd also burn a DVD of everything, of all the original files. I don't burn a DVD of my edited files as long as I have the original RAWs on a DVD. And then that's what we take off-site and just store the DVDs back at my home, and then the hard drives are at the office. And then once I verify that it's in at least two other places, then I clear the cards. So it's pretty similar to what you're talking about, just minus the farm and the farm animals and all that sort of thing.
Okay. Just want to mention a couple of quick items of business here. First of all, we publish on the 5th, the 15th, and the 25th of the month. That's when you can hear the show. And over at photofocus.com, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. You can send in your questions to photofocus@me.com. We're going to have some changes in the show. We're going to start using a different service. Now, we're going to test that. And we may end up with a different feed, so do pay attention to the photofocus.com homepage if all of a sudden we drop out of your iTunes or whatever podcatcher you listen to, because we're gonna experiment with a change that makes it easier for us to get a higher quality version of the show, because no matter what we do, we seem to have trouble in our current configuration. So just look out for that. And lastly, I want to mention our final sponsor today is borrowlenses.com. If you need to test out gear before you drop some money on it, that's a great way to do it. Borrow it from them first. Or if you just want to go to a once-in-a-lifetime trip, maybe to photograph bears in Alaska, and you want to rent an 800 rather than spend 15 grand on it for a one-time event, that's another way to go. You can check it out at borrowlenses.com. All right, we have two questions left, Mr. Kubota. Sally Sorley from Paris, France says, is it okay to crop an image to something other than a standard size? All the frames I see in stores are 5x7, 8x10, but sometimes I like to shoot odd dimensions. I'm an odd shooter too, Sally. I shoot whatever the heck I want and then let them build a frame for it. What does Kevin do?
Yeah, it's okay to be odd. My goodness, yeah. I say do something different. It's great to – I love to crop square. I love to do panoramics. And you don't have to buy the frames from the stores. A lot of the labs nowadays will do canvas wraps, and they'll sometimes make them in whatever proportions you want, you know, just whatever you frame your photo as and whatever you deliver, they'll make the canvas wrap custom size. They may be a little bit more expensive, but you need to stand out. And I think if you're seeing the image a different way, then by all means show it that way. You know, you can get custom frames done. I used to get frames, pre-made frames, just simple black aluminum, like museum type frames, from a frame distributor, and they would make it in whatever size as long as I bought a small quantity of them, and then I would use that to do full frame, like 13x19 full frame prints. And those are not very much more expensive, but you just need to kind of think ahead to get them. But yeah, definitely do something different. Everybody does 5x7, 8x10. Why not do something different?
Yeah, I've talked about this before. I like to buy a standard frame that's bigger than the image by quite a bit so that mm-hmm. I can pay for a custom mat, which is not that expensive.
Yeah, just float it inside the frame, right?
And float it inside the frame. So you buy a standard frame for $40, custom mat for $20, instead of a custom frame for $400.
Yeah, yeah.
So the answer, Sally, is make it any dadgum size you want.
Be a little odd. Be a little odd.
All right. Time for one more question here on the Photo Focus podcast. It comes from Luke Hansen in London, United Kingdom. How do you sort out your keepers when you come back from a photo shoot? Are there images you just discard out of hand, or do you rate each image and then continually cull them until you find the ones you like? Workflow questions are the hardest to answer because there's no right or wrong answer, Kevin, but let's hear how you do it.
I do a little bit of a combination of both. I go through and I will make a pass. I use star ratings in my workflow system. So I'll go through and I'll tag everything that I like that I think has potential as a one star. And then I do go back through. I hide the other ones, get them out of my way, and then I'll go back through and start rating them up depending on how much more I like, and compare similar ones where I can spend more time comparing similar images, and I'll pick the best and bump that up to a 2-star. So I have a system of what each star means depending on where it is in my editing process. But to answer your question, I do go through and work my way up to the final images.
Well, and you use Lightroom, right, Kevin?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I use Aperture, and what I do is I hit the 9 key for anything I know I'm not going to want. Now, this doesn't delete the image. This just takes it out of my view. And it unclutters the screen. Mm-hmm. Then I hit 3 or 4 or 5 stars, depending on what I think of what's left. I go through them again. I usually start 9ing the 3 stars and 9ing the 4 stars, so I get nothing but 5 stars, and that's it. The main thing to do is to clear the field, is my advice. So try to get things out of your view that you know you don't want. I'm not a big proponent of deleting things unless they're just clearly out of focus or black frame, black night, black subject. For instance, mm-hmm. you just hit the button pointing at the ground. Unless it's a major mistake, I'm not a big fan of deleting it because you never know later if it could be worth something. Just ask the guy that has that picture of Monica Lewinsky kissing President Clinton. That was sitting on a hard drive somewhere, and it dawned on him, I better go look for that. I'm not making a political statement here one way or the other. I'm just pointing out from the photographic point of view that became a fairly valuable photograph. So yeah. I'm not a big deleter. I am a big hider. Hide it from view.
I'm kind of a pack rat that way, too. I don't delete anything unless it's absolutely unusable for anything. Yeah.
Well, I mean, come on. Hard disk space has become...
It's cheap enough.
Cheaper than water. Perrier costs more.
Yeah.
It does. It costs more.
And you can't store very many pictures in a bottle of Perrier
can you? Two. I can only get two in.
Two. Yeah. At best.
Well, hey, it's been fun having you on the show again, Kevin. Everybody loves it when you're on. And where can I send people to find you when you're not hanging out with us here on PhotoFocus?
Well, personally, you can find me on KevinKubotaBlog.com. And, of course, our website with all of our goodies and books and software and all that is KubotaImageTools.com.
Super cool. And you can find me on Twitter at Scott Bourne, all one word. That's it. That's all the time we have for this edition of Photo Focus. We will be back on Christmas Day, the 25th. We're here on the 5th, the 15th, and the 25th of every month. So until then, remember what I always say, go out there and make pictures. Don't just take pictures. We'll see you on the next Photo Focus.